Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Henchmen and sort of very early on pulled back and more or less
went
managed,
on holiday
more or less managed things yeah. It was like managing by email, it struck me.
Hello and welcome to episode 2 of the FT Business Book Challenge podcast, the place to discover the best in business writing. I'm Helen Barrett, the FT's deputy work and careers editor. With me is Andrew Hill, management editor.
Hello.
And John Thornhill, innovation editor and FT columnist.
Hello.
The idea is simple. We're challenging you to read 6 classic business books in 12 weeks. Each book is chosen by an FT columnist. You get 2 weeks to read it before we haul our star colleague back into the studio to talk about what makes their choice of business book great. And we would love it if you joined in the discussion by tweeting us using the hashtag FTBizBooks or emailing us at businessbookclub@ft.com. In episode 1, John set our first book, David Nasaur's towering biography of Andrew Carnegie. But before we get to that book, here's the question we always start with. John, what are you reading at the moment?
Well, I've just finished reading Homo Deus by Yuval Noah Harari, who is this astonishing Israeli historian who shot up the bestseller lists a few years ago with his book called Homo Sapiens, which rushed through 70,000 years of human history. And having run out of history to write about, he had to write about the future. And Homo Deus is, I think, an extraordinary examination of where some of the trends that are going on in the world at the moment could take us in the future, and whether man in particular, which has been the smartest algorithm, as he's put it, on the planet for the past 70,000 years, is going to get superseded by an electronic algorithm. Gripping reading.
And is man going to get superseded by an algorithm?
Well, he stresses very much that he's talking about possibilities rather than prophecies, but the logic of his argument, I think, is pretty inexorable, that we are quite inefficient biological, biochemical algorithms, and it's only a matter of time. It might be decades, might be centuries before electronic algorithms become more effective than we are.
Is it a provocation? I mean, is it an attempt to prevent that happening by warning people what might happen?
Well, I mean, he's certainly trying to be as provocative as possible, and I think he wants to stimulate a debate about these things. But I think the logic is clear. I mean, if you believe that computers will one day become as intelligent as humans, then that has profound implications. If computers can understand ourselves better than we understand ourselves, that is a phenomenal moment in human history, I think.
Certainly renders us podcasters a little bit redundant, doesn't it?
You know what? I don't know. I don't know if an algorithm can mimic a very interesting book discussion like this, but we'll see.
Possibly not, but what are the management lessons that you're getting?
Well, I think the big management lesson from it is his final chapter, which is all about dataism, as he puts it, which is, he classifies it as a new religion. And I think he spent a lot of time on the West Coast of America talking to all of the big data revolutionaries. And I think that is one of the massive business themes that's happening at the moment. Companies that are amassing these vast data sets and what they can do with them, and applying machine learning to domain-specific data sets to revolutionise whole sectors of the economy, like health or education or transport. I think that will be one massive theme over the next few years.
Yeah, I agree. And also, potentially, the overreach of worshipping the data in a way that actually renders the human part of it insignificant.
Sure, because I think a lot of the use of that data is dependent on implicit biases in the models that people create. So there's been a lot of controversy around this with predictive policing in America, that there is an inbuilt bias in the models that they are creating. So I think it's a phenomenally interesting, and it's going to be a very controversial area, how these models get developed.
And Andrew, what are you reading at the moment?
Well, I just, interestingly, to John's last point, just finished reading Clay Christensen's new book, Competing Against Luck, for an interview I've done with him, which has a chapter about the risk of being enthralled to data. But the book that
was published in last week's FT.
Indeed. the book that I've been reading with a non-business hat on is by an author who I have to say I didn't know about until relatively recently, Lawrence Osborne. His book, The Forgiven, which is a novel about a couple, an English couple, who are driving to a very fancy party in the Moroccan desert, thrown by a gay couple with all sorts of extravagance. And en route to this party, with the slightly drunk English doctor at the wheel, they run over, either accidentally or on purpose, you're never quite sure, a Moroccan boy, who they then bring to the party. They bring his body, either kill him, they bring his body to the party, and everything unfolds from there about how are they going to deal with this. It's a very, very gripping, rather extraordinary, vivid tale of really a clash of two different civilizations, almost.
You talked about this earlier, and we said it had sort of parallels with Camus, the idea of killing an Arab.
Yeah, it definitely has something of that. It's a very... He somehow managed to get in the language, partly by using Arabic terms, but also in something in the prose. He renders the whole, both the party and the environment in which it takes place, completely exotic and different. And you see this couple plunged into it and plunged into this incredible tragedy. In a way, you are sort of living their experience of not understanding the people around them. The father of the boy arrives to recover the body, and I won't give away the plot, but he wants something from the doctor who has been driving the car.
And what are the management lessons of this?
I'm not convinced I've been able to. I've racked my brains to come up with a business line from this book, but I'm afraid I'm not sure I really have one, unless it is that we should be more careful when we cover the parties of the rich and famous. But
crisis management, that, I think.
Yeah, crisis management, possibly. And Helen, what are you reading?
Well, I went to the FT charity book sale last week, and I picked up a copy of The Rise, the Fall and the Rise by Brick Smith-Start. Do you know Brick Smith-Start?
I don't.
No. She is a very successful fashion entrepreneur. She's probably in her 50s. She's American, but she works in London. What's very interesting about her, though, is, I mean, her entrepreneurial career is interesting in itself, but she had a whole other life in the 80s when she was a member of The Fall. So The Fall, for people who don't know, sort of Manchester band, punk, post-punk, with an ever-evolving lineup, consistently fronted by one of pop great curmudgeons, Mark E. Smith. She was married to Mark E. Smith, and she was a member of The Fall in the 1980s. And what was interesting about her time in The Fall was that she turned this very sort of not a commercial proposition, yeah, quite a miserablest band, into a chart-topping success. You know, they were on top of the pops, and they were glamorous, and they were appearing in magazines, and they had hits. And then she left; it all went wrong. And that sort of sparky entrepreneurial success disappeared from The Fall. So
so she was the entrepreneur in
the
band,
was.
Even though she wasn't the front person.
She was. She brought a certain sort of American brio to, an artistic, very English enterprise. And, she's done the same again, but through her fashion empire. So I think the management lesson there is you can do worse than hire a sparky American. which via the genre of biography brings us neatly onto our set book.
And sparky
book.
Americans.
And sparky Americans, indeed. Brings us neatly onto our set book, Andrew Carnegie, Published in 2006 and more than 800 pages long, the book brings to life the fascinating rags-to-riches story of one of our most iconic business legends, according to the blurb. John, why is Andrew Carnegie a classic business book?
Well, I think this subject is absolutely fascinating in itself. I mean, Andrew Carnegie is possibly the greatest capitalist who ever lived. He arrived in America in 1848 as a 12-year-old penniless immigrant boy and ended up as the richest man in the world. So I think it's a rollicking story of how he managed to achieve that. And Nassau, I think, has written the definitive biography of that story. He's done a phenomenal amount of research and writes very vividly about the story. So it touches upon a great human interest story and also tells you the history of the great explosive growth of American capitalism in the second half of the 19th century and what happened at the beginning of the 20th century.
Andrew, you've been reading, I know because I've seen you reading it, Andrew Carnegie. What did you think?
Yes, reading it for the first time. And actually, well, it's a myth-busting book, apart from anything else. It goes back to some of the original sources and confounds some of the things, certainly, that I assumed about Carnegie. That perhaps the biggest one is that he gave away all his fortune only after the disgrace of having been instrumental in the fatal strike-breaking at Homestead, his steel plant. He makes it very clear, Nassau, that actually this impulse to give away what he had, the fortune he had made, came much earlier, actually. And indeed, one of the things I found most amazing about it was how young Carnegie was when he enjoyed this extraordinary success, and yet how he continued throughout his life when virtually he was virtually retired, as most of us would define it, in his 50s, and yet he continued for another 30 years or more to be an extraordinary live wire of ideas, world-changing ideas. I mean, he really had this self-belief that comes through in every page, and an optimism that's only finally broken at the very end of his life with the First World War.
I mean, I read it for the first time as well, and I thought there were certain themes in this that are so relevant today, it was almost uncanny. You know, immigration, the idea of business leaders as politicians, American industrialization. I mean, John, could you give us an idea of the scope of the book, when it starts and what it takes us through?
Well, it does talk about the entire sweep of Carnegie's life, about how he was born in Scotland, his parents moved to this emerging economic superpower, and how he formed his business empire, really massively opportunistic, pretty ruthless in his tactics, as Andrew has said, but really very ahead of his times, I think. I mean, he was very fascinated by technology. His whole kind of business thesis was that you should buy the latest technology, invest in it massively, accumulate profits as the cycle swung up, and then hang on to those profits and wait for the next crash down so that you can buy the next round of assets on the cheap to ride the next boom.
Could you make a fortune the same way today, do you think?
What struck me very much is that how reminiscent this is of China at the moment. The 19th century America, there was opening up of this vast continent, and Carnegie rode the whole industrialization of America, the road building, the factory building wave that was taking place there. And it seems to me very similar to what's going on in China, where these vast fortunes are being made by providing for this surging domestic demand. And so I think whenever I go to China, I'm always struck by the kind of sheer aggression, the astonishing energy that is in that country. And it seems to me must be very reminiscent to what 19th century America was.
It's also, and I don't know whether you know China better than I do, but it also struck me that he was always working on the edge of the newly forming regulations on things like antitrust. Obviously, there was no insider dealing rule, so he made a lot of money through what we would now categorise as illegal insider dealing. He was always pushing the edge of the new legislation and new rules, and that must be similar to some of the entrepreneurial activity in China.
Yes, one would certainly imagine that. And I think there were obviously very pliable regulatory conditions in 19th century America, and Carnegie and many of the other kind of robber barons, as they were known, were expert at playing those rules. So it was astonishing how quickly you could amass a fortune, how it became very defensible. The barriers to entry became quite high and were ruthlessly enforced.
He wasn't born wealthy, were his? His family were educated, but they moved from Dunfermline in Scotland to America. And they were working class, they were weavers, but they were highly skilled, weren't they?
Well, he certainly believed all his life in self-improvement. He absolutely believed, I think, in the equality of opportunity and that people should make the best of their own lives, and thought that education was the way that you would do that. So he was very much a kind of self-taught man. He really prided himself in the education that he gave himself. So he didn't receive much formal education at all. And I think that was one of the impulses of why he decided to bestow, I think it was more than 3,000 libraries around the world. He really wanted to give other people, kind of budding Andrew Carnegie's, that same leg up that he thought he had had from his own kind of education.
I mean, he had memorized huge, great tranches of literature. And he had always had these quotable quotes. And I think one of the great things that Nassau manages to do is give you an idea of what an extraordinary raconteur and presence he was with this amazing sort of self-taught library in his head. I mean, you want to, at one point, I thought, I just want to be sitting at the table listening to Carnegie holding forth. And the book is as close as you get, I think.
He gave a hint of this in his early life, didn't he? Because he wasn't particularly well educated when he was a child. He went to work in his early teens as a telegraph boy. That's right, isn't it? Where he took messages. It was an early form of communication. And he took messages between businesses in Pittsburgh.
Yes, and he made a point of, I remember this passage where he makes a point of making sure he can recognise when he gets the opportunity to meet one of the Pittsburgh worthies who he's delivering messages to. He memorises who it is so that next time he'll be able to deliver the message on the street if he sees the person on the street when he's en route. So he's already looking at ways to kind of foster his network and to improve his career.
And he also would have been carrying a lot of news reports. Interestingly, he would have kept up with the news and he would have understood the power of the media at that time at a very young age. And his uncles, interestingly, were Chartists, weren't they?
That's right. He had some radical roots.
Mm, yeah.
And so he was able to sort of draw on that, I think, as a bit of an inspiration. Although the book makes clear that his father was not a great inspiration to him. He was very close to his mother, and that's another interesting point. He got married very late in life by comparison even with today. And he was somebody who later on, as he realised he wanted to court a wife, he started to play down a little bit the influence of his mother in order not to appear too much enthralled to her. But she was
His mother lived with him, didn't she?
That's right, yes. Yeah. It was a problem for him, I think, as if I read Nassau's biography correctly. One of the other things that I thought was interesting was from a sort of management point of view, was that it's almost as though he is managing from an early age, and he was, as I say, very young when he made his fortune, remotely. Nassau says that he didn't really want to have face-to-face meetings with his workers, and so he delegated a lot. And latterly, he communicated a lot by telegram and by letter, almost like the modern equivalent of communicating by email or text. Mm. He was in touch, but he wasn't a hands-on manager. In fact, he shied away from that.
Which was very handy when it came to the Homestead strike, because he tried to wash his hands of the whole thing, even though he was clearly implicated.
Yes, he was able to
delegate it all to Frick to manage.
Well, yeah. Let's run through that period, the Homestead strike.
Well, there was a lot of industrial tension around the steel factories, and Homestead. The sparking point was that at Homestead and before that at one of his other factories, he decided that he and Henry Clay Frick, of course, in his own right, built a great fortune and endowed the Frick Gallery in New York. He and Frick had come to the conclusion that they had to break the union. And in order to do so, they brought in the Pinkertons, which was the private detective agency, but which supplied kind of bully boy workers to substitute or to break in and then substitute for the workers that they were going to shut out.
Was that a new tactic or was that widely in use?
Well, Nassau makes clear that they had actually used it, although with less publicity, at another plant. But it was interesting mainly because for Carnegie, who had kind of got himself a reputation as a friend of the unions in his earlier part of his career, the reason why this was so cataclysmic for him was that it actually tainted his reputation, made it more difficult for him to do a lot of the things that he was becoming famous for, including actually some of the philanthropy. Some of the original bequests that he'd made were then rejected, which is, again, reminiscent a little bit of what sometimes happens now when wealthy people's names are put on buildings and then their reputation takes a dive and it becomes an embarrassment for those who received it. There was a little bit of that. It was seen as a betrayal that he had, with Frick, brought in this strike-busting force at the Homestead plant. And when the Pinkertons arrived, shots were fired and there were deaths. So it was really a traumatic moment, turning point in Carnegie's life. And as John said earlier, he wasn't in the country at the time. He was travelling. He was in Scotland, and he heard about it at a distance and then actually tried to absolve himself of any responsibility.
I think that duality is one of the fascinating aspects of Carnegie, which he exhibited all the way through his life. On the one hand, he absolutely chiselled down his workers, took the advantage of every deal that he could, was an incredibly aggressive negotiator and wanted to maximise the profits of all his companies. Yet on the other hand, I think it's not too much of an exaggeration to say that he actually invented the whole modern philanthropy movement by giving away this vast amount of wealth. And a few years ago, I went to visit Skibo Castle, which is this extraordinary estate that he built in, or didn't build, he rebuilt in Scotland. And I spoke to the librarian there, and she was saying that there are letters that they have which show that when Carnegie was in America, he was writing to the estate manager at Skibo, this being when he was the wealthiest man in the world, saying that he thought that the manager was paying the scullery maids far too much money and that they ought to have kept their salaries capped. So he had this kind of infinitesimal detail or minute detail for what his workers were paid, even though he had this prodigious wealth himself.
What's Skibo like, John?
Well, it's a magnificent building overlooking the sea. It was pretty much a ruins when he bought it. He spent a fortune on renovating it to spend all the summers there with his wife and his daughter. And it became this extraordinary magnet for famous people from all around the world. Rudyard Kipling went there, various prime ministers, Helen Keller went there as well at one time. And it became a real kind of intellectual salon. Carnegie used to love holding forth at the end of his dining room table with all these astonishing array of guests. And they would go for these long bracing walks. They'd go for sailing in his yacht up and down the coast. And he also developed a golf course there, which is a really fantastic golf course.
And you, I hear, slept in Carnegie's bed.
I did. I had the opportunity to do that. And what was astonishing about the room, I mean, apart from the wonderful view, was that you realised just how short he was. He was only just over 5 foot. It was a very small bed. And when I went to shave in his bathroom mirror the next morning, I had to bend down because in order to see myself in the mirror. But he was this incredibly intense bundle of energy. He was a very small man, but I think physically he was very imposing. He had an enormous aura around him, and everyone who came across him had a sense that this was an astonishing personality.
And Nassau says that he was always the centre of attention, even though he was short of stature. In fact, some of the amusing bits of the book are about how people described his size. He had a very big head, apparently.
You can see that in some of the photographs in Nassau's book, some of the photographs he's chosen. He is a very striking-looking man.
I mean, one of the things that I'm interested in is when I meet chief executives and others, there's a lot of interest in biography, and this is, I think, why this is a good choice for the first book, long as it is. The biographies get the attention of important people because I think they like to compare themselves against what other people did in crises, you know, how other people's lives played out. Of course, you get the illusion of being able to shape your life, which Carnegie certainly tried to do. In a lot of the cases, he wrote down what he was going to do with his fortune or with his life earlier in his career. And quite a lot of biographies have made it onto our Business Book of the Year award. We've got Alan Greenspan's biography by Sebastian Mallaby on this year's shortlist. And there's been the Steve
Which is yet to be
Steve
published,
Jobs.
Is that right?
That book is yet to be published. The Man Who Knew, I think, out later in October. And the Steve Jobs biography, Bull Volcker's biography, both of those have been on previous shortlist. So it's definitely something that, I think, captures the imagination of business people to read not only about other business people, but also about any great person and how they have developed their career.
Most of the chief executives I meet or talk to, the modern book they all cite is the Elon Musk biography, which I suppose would be the modern day equivalent of Andrew Carnegie.
Yes.
Is there a modern day Carnegie?
Well, Musk is an interesting example of somebody with huge self-belief. And that biography, which of course is written only halfway through what could be still a very long career if he lives as long as Carnegie did, is very good and very interesting about the kind of driven nature of the man. There are parallels, I think, particularly with what John was talking about, with Carnegie's kind of, we must meet the goal at all costs. And one of the things I didn't know until I read the Nassau biography was how Carnegie was influenced by the philosopher Herbert Spencer and the idea that whatever he did, whatever the what we would now call collateral damage of his management style and his hard driving of the workers would be worthwhile for the greater benefit of humanity and the world. That was something that I think very much he thought the market cards would fall as they will, but he, as a great man, had to lead, notwithstanding the sometimes grisly consequences.
And I think that comes through very well at the end of Nassau's biography, because Carnegie very much felt that his life ended in failure, that he spent his last few years endowing various peace institutes. The Carnegie Endowment for International Peace grew out of this whole thrust, that he believed that he wanted to promote peace and harmony amongst nations. He even gave a peace prize to Kaiser Wilhelm II and was very much instrumental in trying to bring nations together and promote peace around the world. And then, of course, all of this, his efforts came to nothing when the world descended into the First World War in 1914, which completely shattered Carnegie. And I think he very much felt that this massive dark cloud had descended on his life, which he never recovered from.
Yes, it's very moving, actually, I think. And he goes kind of silent almost at the end of his life as he lives through the First World War. He lives through the First World War. He doesn't die till after the war is over, but it does. In a book which is absolutely imbued with his great optimism and happiness and
energy.
To see this man virtually disintegrate at the end, I think is quite moving.
I'd like to bring in Yanina Convoy, our producer, who has been rummaging in the FT library to find our original review of the book from 2006. Yanina, what did you find?
So the book was first reviewed in the FT magazine in January 2007 by Stephen Grobard, who is also the author of The President.
So we used to have book reviews in the magazine.
Yes, we did. Yeah. Here we are. Here's
interesting.
The review generally looked quite kindly upon the book and felt that it was an important contribution to our understanding of America's Gilded Age. And certainly the review points out that Nassau concentrates on Carnegie more as a proud Scot and patriotic American, critical of monarchical and aristocratic Britain.
He was, wasn't he? He felt this quite keenly, that certainly in his early letters home, not long after he moved to America, they keep bringing this back, don't they? This idea that Britain's system of aristocracy and monarchy is holding Britain back, and that the American, you know, system is more productive, more well-suited to capitalism.
Yes, given that he was a great fan of Scotland and came to Britain a lot, he was quite rude about the system.
And sort of adopted the manners and the living patterns of aristocrats himself as well. There's a contradiction there.
It is a strange contradiction, but he was very rude about the House of Lords, which of course is not a unique position even among Brits, but there was certainly a lot of that. He published a book, I think it was called Triumphant Democracy, is that what it is?
Yeah.
Which he then marketed strongly in Britain, even though it was essentially a takedown of the British hierarchical system.
So Grobard picks that out in his review.
Yeah.
And what else does he say?
He also picks out that Nassau emphasises that Carnegie didn't regard hard work as a virtue in itself. And to quote the book, nor did he believe that the accumulation of wealth was a sign of his election or a just reward for past diligence. The piling up of wealth signified nothing in itself except that one had been in the right place at the right time, avoided moral vices, and wisely concentrated one's energies and talents. And the review obviously also...
Quite right.
The review also touches on concentrates on his change in reputation after the shootings, his reputation suffered, with some newspapers viewing this as a capitalist massacre. Once thought a friend of the worker, even something of a socialist, he seemed reduced to a grasping capitalist, unconcerned with his employees' lives. It was a review that definitely thought the book was a worthwhile contribution to this man's life.
I think it's also fascinating how his reputation has changed since his death. That initially I think there was kind of enormous respect for him and gratitude for the fact that he'd endowed so many institutions and libraries around the world. And then his reputation very much went through a down phase when he was viewed as this rapacious capitalist, a robber baron. That side of his personality was very much built up, and people focused on the homestead riots and the strike breaking and his kind of aggressive capitalist practices. And I remember talking to some of Carnegie's relatives who said it very much depended on how old you were when you grew up as to whether people gave you a hard time at school or thought that he was someone to be emulated and revered. And they were saying that possibly because of Nassau's book, but some of other recent books that have come out about Carnegie, something of a re-evaluation of him now, that there is a putting, balancing both sides of the scales, that there is that sense that he was an extraordinary capitalist, but he was also a phenomenally generous man. And I think that Nassau has contributed to a kind of rebalancing of the whole reputation of Carnegie.
Yeah, the book certainly brings out the contradictions. I think that's one of the virtues of it.
I wonder if we were writing a review, if the FT today were to write a review of the book, would we write something like that, you know, that we published 10 years ago? Or would we bring in more of this idea of, you know, the robber barons and rapacious capitalism? Because that was written before the crash. Now, would we write it differently, Andrew, do you think?
I think one might well bring out a bit more the parallels with the financial crisis and the reputation of bankers, but also specifically of the very wealthy, which clearly has taken a knocking. And clearly we've focused much more on sort of inequality in the last couple of years, which is something that the book allows you to take a new perspective on. So it might have been a rather different review. I think it would have been just as complimentary, because I think the book is obviously, this is why I was saying last time that it's embarrassing that it didn't even make the long list of our book award back in 2006, because one of the requirements is that the book should be of enduring value. And this is a book I think people will keep on going back to over the years.
I spoke to David Nassau last week. He wrote the book in 2006, so I started by asking him whether he would have written it in a different way a decade on.
Yes, a slightly different emphasis, I think. Carnegie lived in a time of crisis. Capitalism is not capitalism without ups and downs. And Carnegie was very clear that the businessman had to understand that the good times were not going to last forever, had to put aside money, because when the bad times came, it was time to buy. It was time to buy steel mills that were going under. It was time to invest in new coal mines, new iron mines, new transportation. And that for the smart businessman, depressions were a moment of opportunity, but only if one had put aside enough money to take advantage of that opportunity. So I think I would have stressed that a bit more, but I also would have dealt with Carnegie's distaste for men of wealth who didn't produce anything. Carnegie was very proud that he did not make his money manipulating currencies, trading stocks or bonds, but producing something, and producing something that the world needed at a cheaper price than it had ever been produced before. And his notions that there was something noble in creating a product and giving it to a larger public at a lower price, and something ignoble about making money from the buying and selling of pieces of paper, of stock, of currencies, I think I would have dealt with that more. And I would have said more about Carnegie's world, Carnegie's industrialization, industrial revolution, was a past that had vanished, that we were in a new stage of capitalism, one he might not have understood or prospered in.
Now, many FT readers tell us that biography is their favourite form of business book. What is it about biography that makes it perfect for business readers?
I think biography is a grand historical genre because it allows the business person, it allows the CEO and those who hope to have the opportunity to be CEOs, a sense of what is possible and what is not possible for an individual. That when I write a biography, it's always about how an individual takes what's given him or her, sets goals and objectives, and then either meets or doesn't meet them. And what I've understood in working on three immensely powerful men is that, to quote another immensely powerful man, you can't always get what you want. You can't always get what you want, but you get what you need. And these guys never stopped wanting more, never stopped dreaming or extending their visions, never stopped taking risks, never stopped moving forward. And I think that's a lesson that we all want to hear again and again, because we know it's an important one, and one we can't forget, especially the businessman.
David Nassor, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
John, can you give us a one-sentence bluffer's guide to Andrew Carnegie?
Well, I think this is a long book about a short man, one of the most intriguing, successful capitalists of the 20th century, and it is the definitive biography.
The definitive biography. Great. Our next challenge is set by Sarah Gordon, the FT's business editor. Her book, Barbarians at the Gate, a classic business book that tells the story of the leveraged buyout of RJR Nabisco, written by investigative journalists Brian Burrough and John Helyar, and first published in 1989. Here's Sarah with her pitch.
The best business yarns all have a whiff of Greek tragedy, and Barbarians at the Gate is no exception. Any saga of the inevitable fall that follows excessive greed and hubris is extremely satisfying, whether it's King Lear or Lehman Brothers in the run-up to the financial crisis. But what is fascinating about Barbarians at the Gate was that it was one of the first, if not the first, business book to be written like a thriller. It tells the tale of what was then the largest leveraged buyout ever of RJR Nabisco by KKR, Kohlberg, Kravis, Roberts. They were corporate raiders, essentially, who bought the company in 1988 against the will of its swashbuckling chief executive, Ross Johnson. It tells the tale of a new way of doing business and the sweeping away of a whole corporate culture in America. And like all the best books, it's also about America in general, about its history. It's written by journalists, so it's extremely densely and rigorously reported. And it's just a fantastic read that's relevant for anyone looking at M&A today.
John, what do you think? Will you be reading Barbarians at the Gate?
Oh, I've read it several years ago now, but I thought it was a fantastic read. I mean, it really kind of captured a moment in American capitalist history, as well as being a superb account of the kind of personalities of who are involved in this astonishing takeover bid.
Because then anyone new to this book, anyone who hasn't heard of it before, might think this is the story of a leveraged buyout. It sounds a bit dry. Is it dry?
I don't think so at all. I mean, it was written by two reporters who really knew the people involved. They have incredibly kind of colourful tales surrounding the personalities. And I think it is an amazing story of this kind of massive competition. It really captures a moment.
Andrew, have you read it?
Yes, I have, again, a while ago. But I agree with John. I think it's, for me, it's the sort of non-fiction companion to Tom Wolfe's Bonfire of the Vanities, which came out around the same time, both of them conjuring a particular period in Wall Street. And it is the sort of prototype for all the other big investigative books which tell a narrative tale of some great moment in business history. I was interested to see when I was just looking it up recently that Andrew Ross Sorkin, who wrote Too Big to Fail, which was the big account of the crisis, picked it out as his all-time favourite business book, and I think it's on a lot of people's lists.
Will you be reading Barbarians at the Gate? You can join the discussion by tweeting us at FTWorkCareers with the hashtag FTBizBooks, or you can email us at businessbookclub@ft.com. We'll be back in the studio with Sarah in 2 weeks' time to discuss Barbarians at the Gate, and we very much hope you will join us. In the meantime, thank you to Andrew Hill and to John Thornhill and to our producer, Yanina Conboy, and thank you for listening.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. In unscripted conversations with investment professionals, you'll hear real stories about successes and lessons learned, informed by decades of investment experience. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. New episodes are available monthly. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes in an episode today. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.